This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Former U.S. Army prosecutor Glenn Kirshner has predicted that former President Donald Trump will be indicted, asserting that his days are numbered. The article you're about to hear has been taken from Newsweek and has been written by journalist Jason Lemon. The piece is titled Trump's Days Are Numbered. Kirshner predicts ex-president to be indicted. Former U.S. Army prosecutor Glenn Kirshner has predicted that former U.S. President Donald Trump will be indicted, asserting that his days are numbered. Manhattan Supreme Court Judge Arthur Engoron ruled last Thursday, 17th of February, that Trump and two of his adult children, Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump, must comply with subpoenas and answer questions under oath as part of an investigation led by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Glenn Kirshner on Saturday uploaded a short video to Twitter, overviewing that decision and providing his analysis of the situation. Donald Trump will be indicted, Kirshner asserted. I'm not sure which jurisdiction will indict him first, but he will be indicted. The attorney urged his followers to hold on tight because there's more to come. Glenn Kirshner said that the investigative circle continues to tighten around Donald Trump, arguing that Trump's days are numbered. It's coming, he continued. It's not coming quickly enough, but justice is coming. Like Kirshner, a number of other legal experts have assessed that Donald Trump is running out of good options following Manhattan Supreme Court Judge Arthur Engoron's decision last week. If Trump takes the fifth, it can be used against him in the civil case being developed by the New York Attorney General, former federal prosecutor Renato Moriarty tweeted. If Trump doesn't take the fifth, the Manhattan District Attorney can use his words against him. He's between a rock and a hard place. Watch the three Trumpketeers try to wiggle out of this order. Lawrence Tribe, a professor of constitutional law at Harvard University, tweeted. Lawrence Tribe added, civil contempt would land them in jail, with cooperation being their only key to get out of those ugly orange prison suits, not the Trump idea of high fashion. As for Donald Trump, he slammed the judge's ruling in a statement on Thursday, 17th of February. The statement read, "The targeting of a president of the United States who got more votes while in office than any president in history, by far, and is a person that the radical left Democrats don't want to run again, represents an unconstitutional attack on our country. And the people will not allow this travesty of justice to happen," the former president said. The statement continued, "It is a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in history. And remember, I can't get a fair hearing in New York because of the hatred of me by judges and the judiciary. It's not possible." In addition to the New York investigation, Donald Trump may also face a Justice Department probe over his handling of classified national security information. The former president removed classified documents from the White House and took them to his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida when he left office last year. The records have since been returned to the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, but legal experts and former federal law enforcement officials have suggested that Donald Trump could face charges. Department of Justice, this ball is in your court, former FBI Assistant Director Frank Figliuzzi tweeted after the National Archives and Records Administration confirmed that classified national security documents had been taken by Donald Trump. The National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, confirmed in a Friday letter to the House Oversight Committee that some 15 boxes that Donald Trump returned last month after being requested to do so contained classified national security documents. The National Archives and Records Administration has identified items marked as classified national security information within the boxes, archivist David Ferrero wrote. Previously, the New York Times reported that classified documents were included with the records that Donald Trump was required to return. The Washington Post further reported that some of the documents were classified as top secret. Glenn Kirshner gave his assessment of the scandal during an MSNBC segment on Friday, 18th of February. Kirshner said, "That is a 5-year felony. If that were you or me, you can bet we'd already be indicted." Donald Trump also dismissed the classified documents scandal in a Friday statement. In his statement, Trump said, "The National Archives did not find anything. They were given, upon request, presidential records in an ordinary and routine process to ensure the preservation of my legacy and in accordance with the Presidential Records Act," the former president said. He argued if the scandal involved anyone else, there would be no story here. Newsweek has reached out to Donald Trump's press office for comment, but has not heard back in time for publication.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah in the illegally occupied Al-Quds, with a special focus on the British and American groups channeling huge sums of money to the settlers in the Palestinian capital. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's ethnic cleansing and explore what can be done to stop it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report.
The world saw the hypocrisy of Zionism, shorn of its pretensions, when the besieged Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah turned their cameras on New Yorker settler Jacob Fushi as he uttered these infamous words.
"You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it."
Today, Sheikh Jarrah still stands in the crosshairs of Zionist settler mass theft, with the Al-Salahiya family sadistically removed in the dead of night and their house bulldozed to the ground. Sheikh Jarrah is a microcosm for the rest of Palestine, and the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population continues. However, Sheikh Jarrah is closer to us than we think. Those who fund the continuous Nakba there are among us. From Roman Abramovich, billionaire owner of Chelsea Football Club, and Jan Koum, founder of WhatsApp and former board member of Facebook, both funding settler group David, to media mogul Rupert Murdoch, funding the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds for settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. There are some well-known figures involved in these crimes against the Palestinians. But you may be surprised to know that the most prominent Islamophobic figures in both the UK and the US are funded by the same people that fund the settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. The Klarman Family Foundation, based in Boston, USA, has pumped millions into the David settler group cleansing Sheikh Jarrah. In addition to that, it has funded the Center for Security Policy, which gave us former US President Donald Trump's Muslim ban. The foundation has also pumped money into the Middle East Forum, which funded Tommy Robinson, who describes Muslims in the UK as enemy combatants. Another is the New York-based Hertog Foundation, led by Roger Hertog. His foundation has financed not only the David settlers of Sheikh Jarrah, but also the Henry Jackson Society, relentless pusher of Islamophobic policy against Muslims in the UK, the Center for Security Policy, and the David Horowitz Center, which has employed Tommy Robinson, Katie Hopkins, and Ben Shapiro. The New Jersey-based Russell Berry Foundation, led by former managing director at BlackRock and David Rosenblatt, has funded David alongside a U.S. group named the Investigative Project of Terrorism. This group was found to be infiltrating and spying on Muslim civil rights organization CARE in the U.S. The founder of the organization, Steve Emerson, is responsible for creating the myth of there being Muslim-only zones in the UK. The US-based Abstraction Fund also pumps money into David. It's run by Nina Rosenwald, the heir to the Vicks Vapor Rub fortune. She is best known for directing massive sums to Islamophobic groups. These include the Henry Jackson Society in the UK and the Middle East Forum. So, the same money being pumped into Sheikh Jarrah to dispossess the Palestinians there is also being pumped into a city near you to demonize, surveil, legislate against, and even attack Muslims on the streets. We can now reveal that there is a local branch of the main settler group in Sheikh Jarrah based in London by the name of UK Friends of the City of David. The directors of this UK-based operation are the very same figures from its US and Al-Quds-based counterparts. Rabbi Yehuda Mali founded and is the co-president of the Al-Quds-based settler organization. He is a director of the UK branch and also a board member of the US branch. He is also employed by the Israeli Ministry of Education as a strategic advisor. He founded the Hasbin settlement in the illegally occupied Golan Heights of Syria. Another founder of the settler group, also on the UK board, is David Be'iri. He served as deputy commander of the Duvdevan elite Israeli military unit, known for clandestine operations in the West Bank, in which they disguised themselves as Palestinians. In October 2010, he was caught on video deliberately ramming two Palestinian miners with his car and driving away. 7 years later, the Israeli regime controversially awarded him the Israel Prize for Lifetime Achievement. An additional director of the organization is Doron Spielman. He is a vice president of the Israeli settler group and currently works as spokesman for the Israeli military. The only London-based director of the UK charity is Daniel Peters, a partner with the global investment practice at Aon Hewitt. He seems to be the only one permanently based in the UK. Perhaps we should pay him a visit. The David UK branch has received funding from the Erinda Rothschild Foundation, which has also been a key donor to the Sheikh Jarrah Settlement Building Jerusalem Foundation, as well as to organizations known to be Islamophobic, like the Henry Jackson Society and the disgraced and now defunct Quilliam Foundation. Joyce Anley, a conservative foreign office minister, described this organization as carrying out radical settler activities under the guise of tourism. She questioned Israel's closeness to such a group, but now the question must be why the UK Charity Commission allows a group with a stated objective of demographic change in an occupied territory to operate on UK soil. The fact remains that those who fund the existential war against the Palestinians of Sheikh Jarrah are also funding a war against Muslims worldwide.
To discuss the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah and the forces behind it, we're joined today by two expert guests. Asa Wynne-Stanley is an investigative journalist who writes for the award-winning Palestinian news website The Electronic Intifada and also has a weekly column for the Middle East Monitor. He's joined by our esteemed program expert, David Miller, who is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and co-founder of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And now I'm going to go straight to you, David, and get your expert opinion on this, because I know that you've researched extensively into the UK Friends of the City of David and its US equivalent. Perhaps you could just tell us how true is it and how much of money from the West is going into supporting ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine. And also perhaps you could update us on any other groups that may be active in the UK doing similar type of work.
Well, in relation to the Friends of David, I mean, there are literally millions of dollars going in to Sheikh Jarrah and in other places from this organisation, especially from the US Foundation. I mean, you saw some of the people involved there in the film. One of them, the guy from WhatsApp, gave $3 million to the foundation. Now, in the UK, they haven't managed so far to raise so much money. It's in the scores of thousands so far. But they have had some significant donors. They ran the Rothschild Foundation. It's the Rothschild family main charitable foundation in this country. And they have put money into, effectively, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And as we saw in the film, they also give money to other organizations. It was mentioned a couple of times there, the Jerusalem Foundation, an organization which is dedicated to Judaizing East Jerusalem and to forcing Palestinians out. There are many other organizations in my research. I haven't got time to list them all because there are literally hundreds of other organizations who are raising money for specific settlements to fund the IDF and its brutal tactics in the West Bank and Gaza. These are all organizations, by and large, which have a charitable status in the UK. So that this is a very wide-scale problem, but it's not really been dealt with in public debate so far.
That is interesting, especially given the fact, Asa, that, you know, depending on where someone wanted to put their money in support of, let's say, the Palestinians, you could get in a lot of trouble there. That's probably a topic for another episode. But I want to ask you about the earlier on in that report by Bianca, the gentleman from New York who suddenly showed up in a home which used to belong to a Palestinian family. They confronted him and so on. I'm sure you remember it went absolutely viral at the time. Perhaps you could just remind us about how this type of thing is happening. A guy from New York, an American citizen, ending up in a Palestinian person's home. Is he even spending any money himself? Or is it something which is being funded externally, that type of thing?
Yeah, he's probably not really spending much money himself. The Israeli settlers all over the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, are funded and subsidized extensively by the State of Israel and by these foreign foundations, charity. You know, these groups often have charitable status, really, in our countries, in the UK, in the US, and all over the Western world, really. I think it's important to remember that's been happening in Sheikh Jarrah and other neighborhoods of East Jerusalem is really common all over the West Bank. This is exactly what is happening day in and day out to the Palestinians. Palestinians are being driven off their land. They're being driven from their homes and then replaced with mostly European Jewish settlers who have come to take over their homes, be guided by this ideological vision, this racist settler colonial vision. And, you know, it's implemented. We're seeing it. These are just common everyday scenes from Palestine. People's homes are being demolished on the pretext of not having permits. And I say a pretext because almost invariably those permits are never given to Palestinians precisely and solely because they are not Jewish, because Israel defines itself as a Jewish state. It's a state only for Jews with a tolerated minority of so-called Arab Israelis, even though most Palestinians within the state of Israel identify themselves as Palestinians. So, yeah, this is not an abstract thing of, oh, settlements are bad. This is people's daily lives. People have been driven out of their homes because their only crime, quote-unquote, is that they're not Jewish.
And that is obviously a shocking fact,
yeah,
that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, but and money from this country and money from America, money from France, money from all over the Western world especially, is going into these organisations and being subsidised by effectively by British taxpayers, because these organisations, these extreme Zionist settler organisations, have charitable status quite often in the UK and the US.
That brings me on to my next question, actually, because, again, Bianca's report exposed the fact that a lot of money goes into Islamophobic groups as well. So there seems to be this partnership, if you like, between Zionist organisations, which are trying to push the settler expansion programme in occupied Palestine, but then there are all these groups that are being funded as well, which basically go after the religion of Islam and Muslims as well, and so on. So perhaps, again, you could just tell us what you know about this money going into groups like maybe the Henry Jackson Society, for example, that are known for going after Muslims and Muslim beliefs.
Well, David's research, really, David has done more than anyone, really, I think, to expose this kind of, tight connection between the Zionist movement, between the Israel lobby on one hand, and between what's been termed the Islamophobia industry or the counter-jihad movement. And David has done extensive academic work on this over the years, that's really important to look at. There is this real merging of interests, because the far right in Europe, in Western Europe, has for many years, and especially since 9/11, made Muslims, the Muslim population of Europe, their number one enemy. They made the Muslims the scapegoat in a very similar way to Jews in Nazi Germany and in Eastern Europe prior to the Holocaust were made the scapegoat of European racism, of European far-right racism, and even, not necessarily extremists, but the actual states. The British state before Hitler was extremely anti-Semitic, and so in a similar way now, the British state has these very close ties to the Islamophobic industry and is also making Muslims the scapegoat. So it doesn't necessarily take these extremist groups, but the extremist groups are working hand in hand with the state of Israel and the Zionist movement. And we saw, in the VT, Tommy Robinson, one of the most notorious anti-Muslim extremists, he's done these high-profile visits to occupied territory along with Israeli soldiers. There was a very famous photo that he tweeted out of him standing with an Israeli rifle on an Israeli tank in the occupied Golan Heights of Syria.
Yes, I remember.
So these connections are ongoing and intimate.
We will come back to you, David, to go into a bit more depth into the nitty-gritty of these stories that we're covering. But we have a very interesting report to bring on next, which takes us over to Latifa Abu Shakra. She tried to pay a visit to the London-based director of the UK Friends of the City of David, Daniel Peters. Latifa wanted to see how he would justify his involvement in ethnic cleansing.
David are instrumental in the cleansing of Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. Yet most people in the UK have no idea that a branch exists here. Despite the funding thrust into David, their directors have received generally very little scrutiny. We decided to pay a visit to the London home of the only UK-based director of the organisation. On a sunny winter's day, we tried to talk to Daniel Peters. So despite the cleaner informing us that the family were home, they did not open the door, despite several attempts. It's clear to see that they had cameras placed around the premises. So security is an issue for them. What are they trying to hide?
Well, there you have it. So Latifa doing her absolute best to confront people involved in this practice. David, I'm going to come to you on this. What did you make of that? And perhaps you could just elaborate a little bit more on if there are any other directors, any other key figures which should be known to the audience.
Well, most of the directors in the UK branch are based in Al-Quds, in Palestine. This is the only one who is based in the sense of living in the UK. There is one other director who has a registered address here, but it appears also to live in 48 Palestine. So this is an organisation essentially run from abroad, but with one director here who's an actuary who has been involved from very early on in this organisation, and has otherwise very low profile. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? There's an organisation here spending lots of money, raising funds to engage in activities which are, on the face of it, in breach of international law. The wider question here is the extent to which this should be allowed to continue. I mean, this is a guy whose house is not under threat. He's been visited by a journalist. He's not been asked to leave his house, to give his house to a Palestinian, which in some ways would be a fair thing to do, given that he is personally involved in depriving particular Palestinian families of their homes as we speak. But there is no public debate about this, and perhaps there should be. And I suppose this is one of the things which is interesting about this whole issue, is that this goes on under the radar, with nobody really seeing or paying attention to it. And perhaps that's something which is about to change.
I think it is interesting to note that in past episodes, again, we've tried to get in contact with organisations which push a kind of Israeli line in the UK education system. And again, they're just hard to get in touch with, these organisations, these individuals that do this type of work. They just don't seem to have numbers, don't seem to be at their offices, don't seem to answer the door, as was this case. Asa, I'm going to bring you back in. Perhaps you could put forward the case for the boycott of these organisations, why it's so important that we do push this initiative. And again, why it's important to for us to highlight what they're up to, identify who's responsible, and then, of course, that's when the boycott action can come into play.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that none of these organisations, Israel lobby organisations, who are directly involved in ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, for example, seem to want to show their faces at all, because they like to do things behind closed doors. I mean, I find it fascinating because ostensibly, they have all the support they could possibly ever get. You know, the British government endorses this stuff, despite, you know, public-facing statements from British ministers about, oh, we're deeply concerned about settlements and things and the human rights situation in the West Bank. They say these sort of meaningless statements. Despite those kind of statements, in actual fact, the British government is deeply involved and deeply complicit in this kind of ethnic cleansing. And, it allows not only these kind of organisations to carry out their fundraising activities in this country, but also they support Israel at the highest level, at diplomatic level, at the level of allowing arms exports to Israel, and of the tax deductible donations to these charities, the tax exempt status these organisations often have, it does make the BDS movement important, because the BDS movement is a way that people on the popular level can put pressure on Israel and can. Our government is not going to act. You know, thoughts and concerns are going to do nothing. And they're just a way to distract attention from the British government's involvement in these crimes. So BDS puts Israel on the defensive, and it leads to a... it means there's a wider popular pressure against Israel to... You know, there's a cost for Israel to, if it continues these crimes, that we can put pressure on Israel. And this is why, you know, the British government has been, for several years now, has been, you know, threatening to outlaw BDS, quote unquote. Well, you know, they keep saying they're going to do that, but then they don't actually do it. Because in practice, how can you outlaw BDS? You can't really. You can't stop someone.
It's like thought policing, isn't it?
And you can't stop someone not buying something. You know, it's kind of a logical impossibility. So, but, you know, there is measures they can take, to chill and kind of repress public campaigning. I think ultimately those kind of measures are not going to be successful. And BDS has really gone from strength to strength in that regard. So, yeah.
For sure. Now, David, I want to come back to you, because possibly one of the most important questions of this show is related to the fact that we heard earlier on in the episode Joyce Annaley, Conservative Foreign Office Minister, describe the organisation, referring back to Bianca's report, as carrying out radical settler activities under the guise of tourism. So perhaps you could go into what you think of that. And the fact is that it's now surely a question for the UK Charity Commission, isn't it? I mean, are these guys breaking the law?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because to be a charity, you have to show public benefit. And even a conservative foreign office minister is saying it looks like there's not a public benefit here, that actually this is a disguise. This is not about archaeological digs and lovely parts of ancient Al-Quds or Jerusalem. This is about explorations and demolitions to make way for Jewish settlers. And it's, if even conservative ministers believe this is to be the case, then it's quite clear there's a disconnect between what the activities are and what they have said they are to give themselves charitable status. So, they, you know, the next question, of course, is, well, what is the Charity Commission doing about this? And I would urge people who are able to do so to write to the Charity Commission to raise those questions, to say, you know, this is an organisation which is clearly engaging in activity which is illegal under international law, and it should not be given charitable status. And that, hopefully, is the thing which can start to open up the space for a whole series of other organisations, including very mainstream Zionist organisations like, for example, the Jewish National Fund, which is engaged in ethnic cleansing and settlement in the occupied territories in the same way as the City of David people are, but has much more money, has millions of pounds every year going into effectively illegal operations. So I think that this is really the next front for BDS, is to close down all these charities. You know, we start with one and then we close them all. And that's really what we have to do in order to defeat Zionism. We have to defeat the means by which it sustains itself, which includes the money which comes from this country.
And I know that that is a front which is already being used by pro-Israel groups. They are going after Muslim charities, yeah, and things like that, trying to brand them as extremists for what, putting money into Gaza to try and help civilians there and things like that. We are approaching the end of the show, gentlemen, so unfortunately I'll have to stop it there. But I'm sure we'll have you both back on very, very soon in the near future, especially you, David. But that is unfortunately all the time we have for this edition of the show. But thank you for tuning in. And don't worry, we'll be back next time for more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. It's goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The issue of nuclear breakout, that is the time needed for enrichment to produce an atomic bomb, has always been raised by the West and its Zionist and Arab allies. The anti-Iranian axis uses the issue as a leverage to put pressure on Tehran and build a consensus against the Islamic Republic. We're prepared for you an article written by Hassan Shokouhi Nassab, an international relations expert, under the heading U.S. Legerdemain in Vienna. The eighth round of talks in Vienna aimed at removing sanctions on Iran can be considered the longest, the most complex, and at the same time, the most sensitive political negotiations. In the meantime, positive signals have been transmitted from the Austrian capital, showing steps forward, which may be slow, but advancing contrary to those in recent years. One of these signals is the recent U.S. move to restore sanctions waivers on some of Iran's civilian nuclear activities. On 21st of January, the U.S. State Department informed Congress that it has suspended some sanctions against Iran's civilian nuclear activities in order to allow the two sides to return to their commitments under a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Although some describe the U.S. measure as a mere show in line with the interests of the sanctioning country rather than those of Iran, it is only part of the jigsaw puzzle in the provisions over which there is already an agreement as reported by the media. Observers believe the United States is pursuing both overt and covert objectives from this issue, ranging from reassuring its regional allies about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear activities after an agreement and easing worries about Iran's nuclear breakout time, to addressing domestic rifts in Congress, as well as tensions between the White House and the Republicans. The issue of nuclear breakout, that is, the time needed for enrichment to produce an atomic bomb, has always been raised by the West and its Zionist and Arab allies. The anti-Iranian axis uses the issue as a leverage to put pressure on Tehran and build a consensus against the Islamic Republic. They are pursuing their Iranophobia project by showing that Iran's nuclear breakout time is near. This is while the country is not seeking to develop and use atomic bombs based on a fatwa or religious edict by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Mohammad Eslami, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, has also said that the country does not go beyond 60% uranium enrichment. Moreover, from the observer's point of view, the benefits that Iran derives from reaching the threshold far outweigh those of its nuclearization. However, regardless of Iran's official position, the Western media, from the Wall Street Journal to the website Axios, are trying to portray Iran's nuclear breakout time as very near. The Wall Street Journal claims that this time is now less than a year and possibly reduced to 6 months, and the website Axios alleges that the time required for Tehran to produce an atomic bomb is a maximum of 4 to 6 months. Since the start of the eighth round of the Vienna talks until today, the element of time has been used as a tool to exert pressure on Iran and reduce Tehran's maximum demands. A look at the repeated positions of White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki and the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the unanimity of diplomats from the European trio regarding insufficient time revealed a portrayal of a state of emergency, a situation in which Iran is far from rational and deliberate decisions and trapped in excitement. However, as the eighth round of the Vienna talks lengthens, it can be understood that the Iranian team has prioritized achieving the desired result over reaching a swift, unfavorable agreement. Now, at the last minute of the Vienna talks, when some news indicates the drafting of an agreement, U.S. senators disguised as opponents came to the help of the White House in order to lower Tehran's expectations. The summoning of U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, to a secret meeting with members of Congress, as well as the letter of 33 Republican senators addressed to President Joe Biden, can be assessed within this context. even if we assume that the dispute between Congress and the White House is not fabricated. The outcome of the tension is a temporary agreement. The deal, which Iran has opposed so far, but according to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, there is still a long way to go before the 2015 Iran nuclear deal can be revived. It should be noted that in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, and subsequent United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, temporary restrictions were considered for Tehran. In addition to the 15-year limit on Iran's nuclear activities, the resolution included a 5- and 8-year ban on Iran's arms and missile activities, which are called sunset clauses. The arms embargo expired last year, and we will see the lifting of the restrictions on Iran's missile program in the near future. This is one of the concerns of the West and its regional allies. So far, they have made endeavors to make the embargoes permanent, but these efforts have so far got nowhere. The empty place of the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, which previously helped reduce the West's acts of sabotage by approving the plan of proportionate reciprocal action of the Iranian government in the implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, is very much felt. But Tehran has used other means of leverage at the current critical juncture. The firm positions of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, as well as the increasing defense military capability, such as the unveiling of the strategic missile dubbed Khaybar Shekan, can be analyzed in this regard. Therefore, it is expected, by looking through realistic lenses and understanding the current situation, the West will stop making fictitious deadlines and playing the nuclear breakout and other worn-out fruitless games. It is also expected that the Islamic Republic, as an influential player within the region and beyond, would agree to a win-win deal with reciprocal and balanced obligations and rights. Recently, Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi said any possible agreement between Iran and the 4+1 group of countries in the Austrian capital Vienna must include the removal of all sanctions, the provision of valid guarantees, and cessation of political issues and claims. The Iranian president made the remark in a phone conversation with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron on Saturday, as the two sides discussed the latest status of the ongoing talks in Vienna between Tehran and the 5 remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The aim of these talks is to revive the JCPOA. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi said, "The Iranian negotiating team has repeatedly announced that it welcomes the initiatives that would guarantee the provision and protection of the nation's rights." He added that certain political pressures or claims have been made with the aim of maintaining the leverage of pressure on the Iranian nation, which undermined the prospect of reaching an agreement in Vienna. He noted that the Iranian delegation is advancing the talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness, saying, "In the course of the Vienna negotiations, the Islamic Republic of Iran has offered constructive proposals and has examined the proposals made by the other side based on their conformity with the interests of the Iranian people." Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian president, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, said, "Iran's history of interaction with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and the agency's numerous reports all confirming and verifying the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear activities proved the false claims leveled by some countries against Tehran."
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
British sport is once again under fire, and for an all too familiar problem, racism. This time the story flared up in English cricket when one Yorkshire cricketer, Azeem Rafiq, revealed to a parliamentary committee that in his experience racism, without a shadow of a doubt, was widespread. He also claimed that, instead of facing up to the need to deal with it, abuse from his colleagues was not tackled and instead treated as a joke or friendly banter.
Giving evidence to the Parliamentary Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee, Azeem Rafiq stated English cricket is institutionally racist. He recounted the inhuman treatment he endured after his son was still born in 2017. Also, according to Rafiq, in cricket, racist language was used constantly, never stamped out, and the norm, and people didn't think it was wrong. Similar issues have also been reported in English football, with visibly ethnic players repeatedly enduring abuse from the terrace and from other players. The impact has been relentless and corrosive. In Azeem Rafiq's case, he believes he lost his career to the effects of racism over a prolonged period. However, former footballer John Barnes, who echoes the concerns and revelations of Azeem Rafiq, does not think the impact of such revelations will be an end to the issue. He believes institutions will just scapegoat people and think we're making a change by increasing ethnic representation in sport.
Why, after all these years, do racism and other forms of ethnic abuse appear to remain endemic in British sport? And what message does it send out to fans who watch from the terrace and see this sort of behaviour on the pitch? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent should sports people in the United Kingdom feel able to compete completely free of any form of racial abuse? We put that question to the public here outside London's iconic cricket ground, the Oval. Here's what they said.
Anyway, that's another story. Let me just ask you the questions. Do a lot of talking about that. Yeah.
Ready?
Okay. So there's no test of knowledge. I'm just going to fire a couple of questions and see what you think.
You're welcome.
We're here at Oval today. And
we're here today at the Oval. Yeah. And we're asking the public. The recent allegations of racism in sport.
Sorry.
No. First question. To what extent should sports people in Britain be able to compete without racist abuse?
Yeah, of course there shouldn't be no racism at all.
I mean, it sounds extremely unfair that for so many they do end up going to play and just get heckled and their focus is drawn away from the sport that they're playing and suddenly their identity is being attacked.
Well, there's no racism, there's no discrimination of any kind. Everybody just kind of gets brought together. That's what I love about sport.
Well, of course, you shouldn't have to worry about anything like that. You know, sport is sport. There shouldn't have to... Any of those sort of issues shouldn't come anywhere near the sport, you know.
To what extent do you think that British sports people should be able to do their sport without any fear of racism or religious discrimination?
Oh, 100%.
Why?
Well, because it's not relevant to the sport that they're playing.
I know nothing about cricket, but what I know is that it's completely international, it's all over the world, so that's beautiful. It's something that should bring people together, not apart.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think races and all this stuff, it's been, like, you know, for ages.
It's a great shame. It's something that's an ongoing battle by all accounts.
I'm from abroad. I can't imagine there's racism in British sports.
I believe racism is inborn.
Yes.
It's not avoidable easily.
Do you think that British sports people should be able to compete without fear of racist abuse?
I do. Unfortunately, it's very rife and has been for a very, very long time.
They said something on the news this morning. There's this whole thing about people excuse racism by saying it's banter. And this whole thing about bants that has suddenly become a byword for I can get away with saying anything. Oh, just bants, which it's not.
In reality, there is still racism ongoing. We know that is true. There's racism ongoing.
In the honesty of all of it, there shouldn't be any fear of it. I think we've come a long way. Like, British history in regards to colonialism has come a far, long, long, long way. 21st century, there shouldn't be any fear.
To be honest, I don't think any racism I observed. Absolutely. Yeah. It isn't just racist abuse, it's about sexist abuse, it's about inclusion. Everyone should be able to get to the best that they can possibly be.
People should be able to freely participate in any sport.
How does the public feel about cricketer Azim Rafiq and footballers claiming that British sport is institutionally racist?
Institutionalised? I'm not really sure. I wouldn't be able to give a definite opinion on that, but I mean, I can understand that there might be some elements to suggest that.
I think we've been letting it go on for too long, and in that sense it is institutionalised, it's part of the system.
In my standard and in my understanding, it was so exaggerated, and I disagree with you.
I couldn't tell you much about it, to be fair, Paul, but I did see a little bit, and if as the case obviously needs to get stamped out.
Everyone that is racist or thinks racism should belong somewhere, wherever it might be, should not exist, in my opinion. Like, honestly, just change your mind. It's not a thing. It's 2021. Get over it.
That's kind of disappointing because we're at like 2021, so we'll be we should be able to do whatever we want.
It's sad. You know, the fact is that we try to combat so many different elements, but it's still there.
There's one expression here in English language saying this is not cricket. So this means to me cricket is a very, very fair sport, and it's, to me, open-minded to everybody.
Racism is not a good feeling. The outcome is horrible. People should really accept everyone.
I've lived in this country for about 40-something years. My family live in Australia. And I've always gone on about, in Australia, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia was always in your face. So you knew it was there and you could deal with it. In this country, there's a whole veneer of politeness. I didn't realize how misogynist men were in this country. It took me about 10, 15 years to work it out. And if I think that's the same thing, I think that's probably the same with racism.
I'm not surprised to hear about that because I know that racism is many places in this country. Is practicable many places, both secretly and openly. We know of that.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was institutionally racist, but I think it's got opportunity to grow. You know, he would know more about it because he's in the field. But yeah.
It makes me feel sad, but at the same time, it's just the reality. I mean, the British, the UK is quite institutionally racist.
I think it's been acknowledged that there is a massive problem that needs to be addressed. It may be not just in our sport, it might be across the culture of the country, but we're definitely going to deal with it.
Why is there still so much racism in British sport, is the public's opinion.
Just because England has got such kind of deep tradition, deep culture, especially with kind of like the British Empire colonialism only ending about, what, like 50 years ago.
I wish I knew. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. I know, I'm lucky I don't experience anything like that myself, but I imagine it's terrible.
I don't know why. It could be jealousy. They earn plenty of money.
I think there was just an unawareness of, you know, what multiculturalism actually meant.
I couldn't tell you the reason why. I don't think it's sport specific, but I think obviously with the emotions of sport, it comes out a little bit more. But either way, it's got no place.
Because sport is just, you know, a microcosm of of society.
To be honest, I think it's always been there. It's just like now we have more voice to say. Like before, as you say, we've been like. A lot of people, a majority has been living with fear, and now we know, like, we are actually 2021 and we'll be able to express ourselves.
Because I think it's something that is institutionalized, unfortunately, that goes back many, many years.
When people are good, people have reason to pick on them. If people can't be like you, they want to antagonize you. As simple as that.
I think it's always been there and always will be. Hidden under the carpet, brushed under the carpet, whatever you call it. But I think it will always be anti-this, anti-that.
It's something of mine, because I know black people have contributed a lot to this country. You see, when black people do things good, they will say they are British. But when they commit crime, then they will say they are Nigerians or they are Afghanistan or they are from Ghana.
I think the irony is fair, like, and that's the irony to the first question you asked, if there should be any fear around it. I think all racism comes from just fear, it's just ignorance.
I think British people, they are very sporting, very sporting-oriented people. And I read that it's oil from my side.
They have this imperialist domination of the world that they show in the news and everywhere, and so that they think that also, you know, they are entitled to discriminate other because their country discriminate other countries.
I think it's culture. I think the difficulty is culture, is that maybe that communities aren't encouraged to mix and understand each other.
Research by the Professional Cricketers Association revealed 25% had witnessed or experienced racism. Among ethnic cricketers, that figure rose to over 58%. 45% said it came from another player, with 39% saying it came from fans or on social media. 62% said it was disguised as banter. In football, using pre-COVID data, reports of racism rose by 43% between 2018 and 2019, with faith-based discrimination, including Islamophobia, going up by 75%, more than any other form of abuse. Over 70% of fans across England now think professional football in the country has a serious problem with racism.
We asked the public, what impact does racism on the pitch have on racism in the audience?
I think that professional players in any sport, cricket, football, anything, they need to be role models, they need to be better, because they need to understand that their behaviour on the pitch is going to be emanated by thousands, by millions, potentially, of fans.
I think it's completely dependent on the fan. I mean, if the fan is anti-racism, it's devastating. If they are a racist, suddenly their minds, their way of thinking is actually being backed up, and they're suddenly believing it to be acceptable.
The fans, they are not the very educated people, or there's so many different mixed group. Yeah, some of them maybe they are idiot or they say some things, but we cannot accuse whole country because of some idiot in the fans. We cannot say that. Yeah, it could be.
Do fans take their lead from players, what they see on the pitch? Is that, you know, there's an influence there?
I don't think so, but you never know. Everyone's totally different, but I don't think so. I don't think you see anyone specifically going from players themselves.
You know, if you're a public figure, you influence people in the bad way, in the good way. You get influenced by them.
Well, I'm assuming that the majority are going to be appalled if they see anything like that on the pitch. But then there's always going to be percentage that are like, you know, thanks for, you know, raising that I am a bigot and I want to be able to voice my bigotry. So, yeah.
I think in certain way, yeah, it could influence a lot, because, I mean, it depends of your mentality also, you know, like of your backgrounds.
There's still a lot of people out there that have their own views and try to put their views onto other people.
It affects people in different ways.
Why is that? Because there's a certain, I'd say, middle class, establishment, whatever. There's this thinking that's that English exceptionalism. Get over it, guys, you know?
Sometimes it makes potential immigrants to feel unsafe to come to this country. And at the same time, it makes many of us too, who have more things to contribute to the society, to reserve some and say, no, I better go and contribute this thing in another country where I feel I'll be safer and I will not experience such kind of racism that is obtainable here.
The racism on the pitch, if it's not addressed, I mean, it's legitimised, you know.
We asked the public to comment on their view about what racist abuse in sport tells us about the state of racism in Britain.
I'd say that in sports, kind of like the true nature is brought out when you're kind of cheering for your fans, and it can get a bit crazy. I think that if there is racism there, it does show a lot about kind of what's in the true nature of British people, and it's quite sad to see that as well.
There's clearly like a plague, a virus of racism that still, you know, is deep embedded in the system, and it shouldn't be there. It should, you know, should be out, you know, something that players shouldn't have to worry about, and